Welcome to Jaipur Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This episode is the edited version of a live session from the Jaipur Literature Festival 2021. All Power Corrupts. Amish Tripathi, Kim Gattis, Pavan K. Verma, Pinaki Mishra, Pinky Anand, and Suhail Seth, moderated by Vikram Chandra.
Obviously have power, I think, as the moderator for the next 1 hour, but I'm going to try and not let it corrupt me, well, not too much anyway. The subject obviously being all power corrupts, and I'm not going to say all that much to start off with because I think I'll leave it with a panel like we have. I think it's best for me not to stand too much in between them and you, and also try and shape what they may or may not believe one way or the other. But obviously, the concept of power and the concept of the possibility of power corrupting is something that is very much at the front and center of just about everything that we talk about, from political power to the power in offices, to the power of the rich over the poor, to the power of a boss over a subordinate, the power of a teacher over a student. There's power. Now, the question is there something inherent in power itself that makes all power corrupt? Or is there something else that has to be looked at? And one of the questions that I'm certainly, quick sneak peek, going to be coming to in some of the questions that I'm going to be throwing is the question of checks and balances. Does power corrupt by itself, or does power only corrupt when there are no checks and balances on the exercise and the abuse of that power? And where does this leave us all in the 21st century? I did say I'm going to cut down my own time right now, maybe have another couple of extra questions thrown in at the very end, because I don't want to stand between you and the panelists. So Pavan Radma, you go first. You have 2 minutes and your time starts now.
Thank you, Vikram. I think the key to understand the validity of this proposition, which I support, is to try and understand human nature. In a competing world, if an individual in any field, but especially illustrated by politics, if you acquire power, there is a tendency for you to believe that you, as that repository of power, can bend rules in accordance with those measures required to sustain your power. Human nature is such, and by the way, we must go back to some of the inherent wisdoms in our own tradition. Tulsidas in Ramcharitmanas says, Nahi koi as janma jag mahi, prabhuta pai jahi mad nahi. No one has yet been born on this earth who, once he or she acquires power, does not become arrogant. Mother, that intoxication of power. It's very important also to define what is corruption. We are not talking here, ultimately, of financial corruption only. Corruption is when you are prepared to deviate from principle or take shortcuts, which are all geared to the sustenance of the power that you have. What does that mean? So therefore, all democracies are based on the assumption that a person with power is likely to be corrupted in pursuit of that power, and therefore democracies put checks and balances on that power. This is a tribute to the instruments on principles of democracy. It is not in any way
that I think is the console's way of saying that Pavan Verma, your time is up. I'll allow you to conclude your comment when we come to the questions, but we've got the gist of what you were saying. So just to remind everybody that first drum roll says you've got 30 seconds left, and the second drum roll starts, that's it. The speaker is cut off. Amish, I'm going to come across to you next.
Amish, you're on mute. You need to unmute yourself. We'll give you the extra 10 seconds.
Yeah. Apologies. Okay. I think it was Robert Caro who said that power doesn't corrupt, it reveals. So it's not power that corrupts, it's greed, it's envy, it's anger. You know, these are emotions which can lead you towards corruption. There are, the Dalai Lama, for example, exercises tremendous power over his people, over his nation. No one can accuse him of being corrupt. And corruption exists amongst the powerful and the powerless as well. Someone may be taking a bribe, but someone is actually giving that that bribe as well. And one of the things that comes from our ancient Indian traditions, that things like power, things like sudden wealth, even things like grief are actually challenges. They are challenges which reveal what you are actually made of inside. And we might think we know ourselves, but truly it's only when we are tested that we discover who we truly are. So power in that sense is a challenge and an opportunity. So if you, in the wake of receiving power or suffering grief or suddenly getting wealth, you'll either leave yourself ashamed of yourself or you leave yourself proud of who you truly are. So actually power in that sense is an opportunity. It's a challenge to reveal who you truly are. It doesn't corrupt. You may have that sense already. Power is a challenge. And to, even I'm a follower of our traditions of Lord Shiva, of Lord Ram, Pavanji, quoting Tulsidas ji himself, Lord Ram had tremendous power. He wasn't corrupt. So therefore, that power showed who he truly was. And that's the opportunity that comes with this. Therefore, I oppose the motion that power corrupts. It doesn't corrupt.
All right, Amish, I had some questions on that, which I will throw to you once the question and answer session actually starts. Kim, let me pass across to you.
I'm against the motion, not because I believe that power doesn't corrupt or that absolute power cannot corrupt absolutely, but because I want to believe that there is another way of looking at power. You know, I come from the Middle East, and I've lived through and covered some of the worst abuses of power. Power is wielded at all levels by the bureaucrat, by the prison guard, by the dictator, but I've also seen power used for good, to help, to save. So I want to believe that power can do good and that good people can become powerful and remain true to their moral compass. Otherwise, what are we saying? In essence, we're saying that only the powerless are good. Without some power, you cannot affect positive change around you, in your immediate community, in your society, in your country. As Amish was just saying as well, power can attract the corruptibles. That's what Frank Herbert said in his novel, June. But I want to look at leaders like Angela Merkel in Germany, like Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand. And I want to believe that power also attracts those people who want to do good, who can hold on to their moral compass. And I also want to believe that there are more people like them out there. I really don't want to live in a world where no one with power can do good and where we are, in essence, resigned to the idea that evil will always.
All right, we do have, I think, another 20 seconds, but if you're leaving it at that, Kim, we'll return to you a little later. Pinaki? You're on mute, Pinaki. You have to unmute yourself.
Thank you, Vikram. So on a philosophical or intellectual plane, one would do well to remember, I think, Abraham Lincoln's words, any man can withstand adversity. If you want to test his character, give him power. History is borne testimony, I think, to rulers who wielded absolute power and never been accused of wielding it corruptly or having been corrupted by the absolute power. We have enormous examples of Emperor Akbar and Emperor Ashoka before that, to mention only two, who wielded absolute power with absolute benevolence and for the larger good of the people they've ruled over. Yeah. Now, you know, I think the notion of exercise of power really depends upon the person exercising it rather than on the nature of the power itself, absolute or otherwise. You know, to draw from Shakespeare, the fault lies not in the nature of power, either limited or absolute, but in ourselves. The vast majority of us, Vikram, don't fall into either category of good or bad men, but instead really we float between the vice and the virtue. And, you know, I can only draw an example from the immediacy of my life, where in modern day democracies, there are instances of elected leaders who have been exercising absolute power and who wielded it dispassionately only for the public good. You know, the leader of my political party, Naveen Patnaik, Vikram, has wielded almost absolute power that this country has seen for the last 21 years and has shown that power can be viewed not as an end in itself, but as a means to an end to transfer the lives of people. And the people have responded by trusting him with even more power in each election, which he has then used as a mere repository of trust and to further provide greater succor to them. Am I still on, Vikram?
About another 5 more seconds, I think.
Okay, so the concept of absolute power, of course, is anathema in modern day, as Pavan has already said.
My seconds went, but thanks, Panaki. We'll get more chance when the question answers.
Sure.
Pinky Anand, over to you.
I am standing here, Vikram, for speaking against the proposition. Let me make myself about 3-4 points very quickly. Firstly, the question of power. What is power? Should there be power in the world? There has to be power. There has to be a churning. There has to be an evolution. There has to be a way forward. And for that, power is something that is imperative and we can't do without it. So that's the first nature of power. Secondly, I think what has become fashionable is to take up this saying of Lord Acton, which incidentally has been changed around a bit because it doesn't say that all power corrupts. It says power tends to corrupt and take that forward. But I think in today's democratic world, by and large, the way we are functioning, people give the elected representatives their powers and the powers are controlled or restricted or otherwise managed by checks and balances, both by institutions as well as by the checks and balances of the people. And of course, it's the will of the people. So when you choose the people who are sitting there, you've chosen them for purposes of acting out that power and position and that power and control, which will ultimately, of course, lead to public good. There may be aberrations, but that's another story altogether. I also think that what is this entire statement or axiom of Lord Acton was in the 19th century, in the Napoleonic era, and the era when there was upheavals, he wasn't really dealing with the democratic world as it stands today. And I think we have shown with the test of time that institutional challenges, institutional controls, checks and balances have ensured that constitutional democracies are able to function. And of course, ultimately, it's the will of the people that is the last. On the last statement, which I would like to make at this point of time, is what is power in any case? Today's power with the digital world is where the power lies with the people. The power lies with knowledge, the power lies with technology, the power lies with access. And that power is something which is to be manifested itself. You need a direction and you need to control, you need to manage more than control. And with that, obviously, the statement that all power corrupts is hopelessly misconceived.
All right, Pinky. So, Hale, I'm going to come to you to wrap up the first round of comments.
So I want to establish the context of this adage or this quotation. As Pinky said, Lord Acton, but it's actually attributable to William Pitt. And he made this comment in the light of a lesson that he wanted the parliamentarians of Great Britain to learn. I completely agree with Kim that there are a lot of people who use power for good. But our case here is where absolute power is defined more in political wrappers. It's more political power that we are talking about. It's unbridled political power that is then used to abuse the system, of which we have many examples across the world. Yes, you're absolutely right. There are exceptions. There are exceptions like Ashoka, like Chandragupta. There are exceptions, as Kim very rightly said, about Angela Merkel. But if you examine the context in which power is unleashed by people who have it, they tend to lose the plot. They are blinded by their own power rather than by the rationale of distribution of that power for the greater good. I have not had the privilege of not knowing him as well as Pinaki does, but having met Biju Patnaik, Naveen Patnaik, and Naveen Patnaik represents, to my mind, compassionate benevolence, which comes with an understanding of what the people seek. But our contention is, this is more the exception and not the rule. And, you know, Pinaki quoted Shakespeare, and let me revert to Shakespeare. But Shakespeare said, the good is oft with the bones, the evil lives long after. And our contention is, wherever power has been abused, wherever power has been misused, that denominator or that denomination of power is what people fear. And therefore, they attribute the absoluteness of power to the absoluteness of corruption. And our point is, till you remove the absoluteness, you will continue to fall between two stools. It is not our belief that everything is bad.
Right, Sahil, thank you so much for that. Now, just to sort of level the playing field out for a bit, maybe I'll fire some questions to ensure that I'm exercising my power in a fair manner, not in a corrupt manner. I'll try and fire some extra questions from the poor side, just to balance out this debate. Amish, Pinky, Pinaki, Kim, there's one observation that strikes me from hearing what all of you said. Amish, you were saying that it's not the power itself that is corrupting. If people are good, and that I think seems to be what many of you are saying, if people are exercising it correctly, if people are good people, if they're using it as a challenge, then that's great. But if you look at the real world, for every example, as Sahil was saying, of benevolence of people who are using it correctly, there are lots of examples of people when you give them power and you give them complete power, and the checks and balances that Pinky was speaking about don't always exist. In that case, Amish, in more cases than not, when you have a lot of power, isn't it misused? Because that's who we are as humans, unfortunately. That ideal situation doesn't exist.
Look, the choice that a society would make would be dependent on the worldview of that society and what they think the society's approach is at that point of time. For example, in the Indian way, in the ancient Indian way, there was no absolute monarchy actually. If you read Chanakya Niti, if you read the works of Thiruvalluvar, there were actually restrictions on the power of the king. The concept of absolute monarchy actually came with the Turkic invaders, who we call the Delhi Sultans and the Mughals, right? The Persian concept, or even Plato's concept of, you know, men of silver, was actually his thought was that men of silver are possible. Therefore, he believed in finding them and giving them absolute power so that you can make a better society. In ancient Indian way, during the Ram Raja time, yes, that was Treta Yuga. It was believed men of silver were possible, so they were given absolute power. But during Chanakya's time, you read Chanakya Niti, they were very clear their approach was men of silver are not possible. Therefore, you must have restrictions on the absolute power of king. Chanakya Niti clearly says that. Thiruvalluvar clearly says that. James okay. Buchanan, the modern economist of, when he said what governance structure should be set up, again assumed that such men of silver are not possible. So again, the point I'm trying to make is
you seem to be
the choices society makes is dependent on what their worldview is. At this point of time, are men of silver possible? I don't think so. Honor is not considered, really high up there as a value. So values can change in society. Right, and therefore you decide what power you want to give.
So I would think that in the present environment, in the present system, if you're not being idealistic, then power can be dangerous. Would that be the conclusion you'd take from what Amish said?
Thank you, Vikram. I want to make a few quick points. The example was given of Dalai Lama. I don't think Dalai Lama represents power in the sense we are discussing today. He's a great moral influencer. We are not talking of saints. We are talking of power in the practical realm. And there I want to say to you that human nature is the bedrock of the assumption that if you have untrammeled power, it is likely to corrupt your sense of the moral compass. Now, why does democracy, which does away with absolute power to the extent that it can, provide so many checks and balances? It is precisely for this reason that unless those checks and balances exist, power will corrupt. And by corruption, as I had earlier said, I don't mean financial corruption alone. It means a sense of belief in your own invincibility. It means the belief that you can make a deviation from rule and get away with it. It can mean an intolerance to another point of view. It can mean many things, which in my view are tantamount to corruption. So that is indeed human nature. Now, giving the example of Lord Ram, when I quoted Tulsidas, Tulsidas is saying that human beings, and we are talking of human beings, not divinities, human beings. Okay. There is not one born so far who, when he acquires or she acquires power, will not be intoxicated by it. Therefore, the point I'm trying to make is the exceptions exist, as Suhail also said. And there are very few. There are very few. Even in the case of Akbar, even in the case of Ashok, I can point to you the fact that even in their regime, largely notable for their benevolence, there was concentration of power and minority opinion, dissenting opinion were treated as, in a sense, anathema to that concentration of power.
Okay.
It's not as if it allowed for all kinds of dissenting opinions. Even the Deen-e-Elahi was ultimately an experiment which he jettisoned, and his contemporary historians said.
Okay, Pavan, you get a chance to speak a little bit more in the rebuttals, and I'm just trying to move this on. We don't have that much time to. I want to get everyone a chance to answer this question. Kim, when you look at what's happened in the Middle East, now, as I said, if you move away from the ideal concept, in an ideal world, we should, you know, you can have power and that power will be exercised for good. And I take your point that you don't want to have a situation where everybody is completely powerless. But if you look at the reality of the world, you look at the reality of human history, you look at the reality of, for example, what all that's been happening in the Middle East, if you look, if you were to be real about it, then what would your stance be? Would you say that from what we have witnessed around us, more often than not, people have exercised power in a negative manner?
I know you're trying to move me from against to for, but I'm not going to.
I mean, there's sort of a balance on this panel.
Because I think Pavan makes a great point about human nature. And when you look at human nature, you have to decide whether you want to live your life with the fundamental perspective that human nature is good or human nature has its flaws and is intrinsically doomed to do bad in a way. And as as I grew up in the civil war in Lebanon, you know, really surrounded by the evil of human nature, of war, of abuses, of militias, etc. The only way that you survive through something like that is by believing that good will prevail. And I know that it sounds Pollyannish, but having lived through the experience that I have, I can assure you that I'm not Pollyannish or naive about the fact that in history, it has been good has in some ways been the exception. But if we give up on the concept being able to prevail, then we are in essence giving in to evil. And I simply refuse to live my life on a day-to-day basis without holding on to the thought that good people can become powerful and can do good. Because my co-panelists have made some excellent points about that. First of all, power doesn't necessarily corrupt, it heightens pre-existing tendencies towards corruption. So therefore, we often see that power attracts those people who are corruptible, but it does also attract those people who are trying to do good. I think that the statement has a lot of hyperbole in it. What is absolute power today?
Yes.
In democracies, do you see the checks and balances? But even in dictatorships, you see the checks and balances of the will of the people, as Pinky mentioned. You know, you see Vladimir Putin
right of the person
being challenged in his power by people like Alexander Navalny. So for me, it's a question of outlook on life and on wanting to hold on to the belief that good will prevail and that the arc of history eventually bends towards justice, even if it's not in our lifetime.
All right. So, Hale, are you being too negative when you say that, look, power will corrupt, you know, all power corrupts? Because as Kim said, if you believe that, then you believe that basically human beings are incapable of being good.
No, I think Kim made a different point, if I may try to interpret what she said. She said, please don't negate what's good. Please don't imagine there will be no good. And please don't wish for evil to reign. I mean, in a manner of speaking, it is not our contention for the motion that the world is full of evil people. I mean, even Shakespeare said, and I quoted him earlier, but look at the dilemma of Richard III. Look at the dilemma of all the kings that he profiled in deep terms. That is not our contention. Our belief is the world has been replete. She talks about Lebanon. You look at today, you look at Saudi Arabia today. Would you call it a benevolent dictatorship? Would you call it a dictatorship? Would you call it absolute power? What would you define it as? Now, see, and this is a very important point on which I would love for Kim to comment because she's the expert amongst all of us. There have been people who have told me that the Isfahan time of Iran or the time when the Shah ruled, for some was the golden period, for some was a pernicious, it was a vicious time. So you don't even understand how people interpret the usage of power. And sometimes, because we are human beings, we interpret it based on our conveniences. Whether the Kurds would align with the Salman, with the Saddam or not. So our belief is the world is not all evil, but the world has seen, because as Pavanji rightly said, of human frailty and human absolutism, we have seen that wherever human beings have the opportunity, those who are corrupted, corruptible and evil, they exercise that power in an absolutely pernicious, evil form. That is our contention. Everyone is bad, everyone is evil. We're not television anchors.
Thank you. Neither am I. I'm happy to tell you. So in case that was a dig at me, neither am I. All right. Pinky, I want to come to you and Pinaki on one of the points that you made. And all right, when you're having a situation of all power corrupts and power corrupting, you said yes, but there are checks and balances. Now, the question that I want to ask you is that that's one of the areas where many people have started to put questions on the checks and balances. Are there always checks and balances? In an autocracy, obviously, they're not in a dictatorship. No, they're not in a monarchy. They're not. Even in a democracy, there are people who start to say, what happens when the checks and balances start to fray? What happens when, for example, you know, bail doesn't become the norm and jail becomes the norm or fundamental rights are not protected or whatever it is? And these questions come up even in democracies, not just in ours, across the world. Questions on checks and balances are always is something which has a question mark. Why are you so sure, Pinky, that the checks and balances will always work to curb the excesses of power?
You know, if you go back to the mythological times, you'll find that there were conscience keepers of those times. In a democracy, by and large, I'm talking about democracy in today's world. I'm not talking about the others as much. So in a democracy, you put into place not a check and a balance. So therefore, when you put into place systems which ultimately prevail, and we found that happening through historical evolutions, that you do have, if one check and balance is, for any case, frail, I wouldn't say not working, but let's say it's frail, it is weak, it's not functioning as it should, then you have the other systems come into operation. And finally, what is the biggest check and balance in a democracy? You have the will of the people being manifested through what? Through a democratic election. And you can always choose to either shift that power into somebody else's hands if it doesn't appeal to you. That's what I'm saying. The whole principle of today's world is taken away by two features. Will of the people and, I would say, the expression of people, to the extent that knowledge, access, technology, and that is put into the hands. And the third part, I do think, which is important, it's not part of your question, I know, but nonetheless, it's a perceptional issue. What is good and what is bad? What is corrupt and what is corruptible? The whole purpose of an exercise is, today it has also become fashionable to say that any action which is not populist is something which is a corrupt, not as in a financial corruption, but possibly in a policy manner, it's corrupt. And it's exercise of that power. So if it doesn't appeal to a cross-section of people in any democracy, the challenges are taken up and, you know, there's crying horse over the woods to say, this is bad. This is not as per our desire. Therefore, it is bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pinaki, let me throw to you and then I'm going to give all the panelists their time for rebuttal, right? And one comment from each of you and then we'll move to audience questions. Pinaki, the question of checks and balances, because a lot of what is being said seems almost presupposing that, look, people will eventually be good, there will eventually be benevolence, and in case somebody is not being benevolent, there will be checks and balances. Is that a safe assumption to make in your view?
Over the years, I've been told that what happens in your Jaipur literature festivals is that most of these debates eventually come to a consensus, and there are no absolutisms in the sense of for or against being black and white. And I find that's exactly what's happening now. Increasingly, I find even those who are for the proposition are coming around to the view, I think, that look, so you have just a moment.
I'm hearing even the people against the proposition saying you are
broadly coming around to the view. Look, what is your question? What is the proposition today? The proposition is all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So goes the axiom, but is it an absolute truth? Now, nobody here seems to agree that that's the absolute truth. It's a relative truth, number one. And I think everybody agrees it's a relative truth. Like I said, of course, there have been a vast number of cases where there has been power which has corrupted and therefore power which has been wielded in a corrupt fashion. But against that, there has been an overwhelming number of cases over history where power has been wielded for the larger good of people. And because a lot of people who have wielded power have felt that, it's only a means to an end, which is serving people. So that being so, in any case, in the modern day scenario, your question of is it an absolute truth is completely inaccurate, because the checks and balances today are not just one institution or two institutions or three. They work in tandem. Kim mentioned Putin, possibly the last vestige of absolute power in the world today. She mentioned the Middle East. Look at Iraq. Look at Libya. Look at Egypt. Look at so many of these, Iran, so many of these countries where there was absolute power, where for brief periods you have wielded absolute power with absolute power corruptly, and you've been completely weeded out. So therefore, the shelf life of people who wield power and in a corrupt fashion is very short. The shelf life of those who wield power benevolently has been much longer. History teaches us that. And going forward, with the majority of the countries in the world now, becoming democratic in nature, with multi-party systems, rancorous oppositions, there's no more possibility of absolute power in any case, of either it existing or being wielded. So therefore, that being an absolute truth in 2021 is totally impossible. It's an impossibility.
Rebuttal round. Everyone, each one of you gets about a minute and a half, let's say, to quickly come up with some rebuttal. So I'll go in the same order as we started with. Pavan Varma, you next. I noticed you shaking your head while Pinaki was speaking.
I just want to say that we must understand the proposition. The proposition is that all power corrupts. This does not mean that there have been no good people in the evolution of history. It is an assumption or an inference we are drawing from verifiable historical experience, by which we can say that when an individual or a system acquires power, there is a much greater chance of it being corrupted in terms of its own principles, because that is the nature of power. It is not about the level of checks and balances we have today. Those checks and balances are provided in a democratic setup precisely because democracy understands that power corrupts. And therefore you create checks and balances, and in spite of them you have a situation in democracies where parliament may not function as it should, where the judiciary is compromised, where people who dissent are arrested, where media houses are under pressure, and therefore The principle remains the same, that the checks and balances have been created precisely because power corrupts. So while we can say that there are limitations to that power, and as Pinaki said, that the shelf life may not be long thanks to the powers of democracy, it does not negate the principle that we are trying to put forward, that power has a tendency to corrupt, and that is the empirical basis.
All right, Pavan, time up. Amish, your rebuttal to everything that you heard.
The proposition was that power corrupts. The point is, if you look at human civilization itself, we've emerged because actually we have got leaders. Humanity has actually worked together. Can we not agree that we are better today We're in a better situation today than where human beings were, say, a million years ago when civilization had not started, when group thinking had not started. Right. So checks and balances I support, and checks and balances comes from a perspective that bad people with power can do a lot of harm. But what it also does is prevents good people with power with doing a lot of good. Abraham Lincoln, for example, is seen as one of the greatest leaders of this millennium today. But if you read the the contemporary text of those days, Abraham Lincoln was actually called a dictator by some. By many, actually, because he was breaking many of the checks and balances the Constitution had put in. But did he not achieve good with it? And that's just one example. There are many examples like this, because powerful leaders led humanity forward. There are many bad people who did harm. I'm not denying that. That is the nature of humanity. So it's not power that corrupts. It just reveals. I will restate my point. Because good people have actually done good work.
All right. Yeah. Hang on. Let me go in the order that we started. Kim, you next. What about?
So I'm going to throw a short curveball in here first to answer Suhail, because he does raise a very good point about how power is perceived by those on the receiving end of it. If you look at the Middle East, and if you look at Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, you will have those who live under his rule who say that his absolute power has been for the greater good of the country. And you have others who have lived under his rule who have been his victims, who have been in jail or whose father or husbands have been killed, including Jamal Khashoggi in an Istanbul Saudi consulate in 2018. So that's an interesting perspective as well. But my rebuttal the reason why I stand by my position is because I really do believe that power per se does not necessarily corrupt. It does attract the corrupt.
Any rate.
Does heighten pre-existing tendencies towards corruption. And I agree with Pavan that checks and balances are there in a democracy to make sure that there are not excesses. But I do certainly believe that people like Angela Merkel and Jacinda Ardern, even without some of these checks and balances, would be able to maintain their moral compass.
All right, Pinaki.
So, as a lawyer, Vikram, I have to go by the purity of the debate and the purity of the question. As I said, the purity of the question is it an absolute truth? Fact is, it cannot be called an...
The question is, all power corrupts. That's
and right. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So goes the axiom, but is it an absolute...
No, that's not the topic. That's the explanation.
That was the question. That was the proposition.
All power corrupts. Full stop. That's the problem.
Oh, I see. So I thought the entire.
No, you can come to our side. You come to our side. We are happy to welcome you.
So we have no in any case,
people balance. Come to our side.
I've made my point that no absolute power does not necessarily corrupt. Absolutely, absolute power can be wielded for the benevolence that it can engender for larger good of society.
And we are making Mr. Nayak an exception to this debate.
All right. That's it, Pinaki. Happy Pinky. Let me get a sense from you. Then I'm going to go to audience questions.
Well, on the proposition, all power corrupts, it's absolutely inconceivable and it's a misnomer. There's no question. Power is necessary as a part and parcel of human civilization. You do need to manage. You do need to not control is also there, but so is manage. When you want to manage, you need to give power unto a group of people, what in whatever capacity, a captain of a ship, a judge in the Supreme Court, a politician, a parliamentarian. People are needed, the legislature, laws are to be enacted. So therefore, it is a necessary part of society to have. So there is no question that all power corrupts. It cannot. Power is there in order to take care of a situation and to actually manage it. Therefore, it is a necessary part.
The way to hell is paved with good intentions.
Now, Pinky has also moved to our side.
Not really.
The way to hell is paved with good intentions.
Last point.
I will just say, I want to congratulate Kim and Pinaki for moving so swiftly to our side. And I want to reiterate what we said at the beginning of the debate, that is Pavanji and I. This is the corrupt use of power by Suhail. No. You're sitting in Nehru Center. That's a bit rich from Nehru Center to tell us about it. But, I mean, I want to make three very quick points. As Kim rightly said, and this is true, power per se is not bad. Its usage or abusage is what we are discussing. B, we have seen across history, it's been chronicled, it's been written in literature, the excesses and the abuse creates more devastation than the goodness that we keep talking about or we are talking about. Third, it is not our contention that there is no good on the planet. Our contention is when you look at the topic, and the topic is absolute power corrupts.
No, it isn't. The topic is not that.
See, Vikram Chandra is the moderator. You're the official solicitor general. In this court of public opinion, he is the reigning deity. So the point I'm making is, our contention is that all of you have agreed with us, for which we are grateful, and we want to share this intellectual power with you, with equanimity and with affection. Thank you for sliding over to our side with such ease and seamlessness, and may God continue to bless you.
I'm trying to keep track of where everybody is actually staying, because there are certainly at least a couple of people who seem to be converging towards the center. Time now for audience questions, which may help in further revealing where exactly everybody is. All of you have a question, just start sending them in right now. So, Fahima asks, why is it that even in a democratic setup, the public seems to be the least powerful?
Brilliant.
Interesting question. I'm trying to say, figure out who all want to make. Pinaki or Pinky, would one of you want to do that? Because, and I think that's a really important question. Even in a democratic system, public seems to be the least powerful. There used to be a time across democracies everywhere in the world where the rights of the individual, the rights of the citizen, were the single most important thing. But if you look at the world around you today, even in democracies, there's sometimes a questioning about the right of the individual. Do people still have that much individual rights, and are they as powerful? Is the individual as powerful as the individual should be? Pinaki, you got your finger up. You want to answer that?
Vikram, I fought six general elections from 1996 till date. I've won four, I've lost two for the Lok Sabha. Let me tell you, the power that the individual voter wields in a democracy is awesome. Believe you me, it is awe-inspiring. When I've won, I've found it awe-inspiring. When I've lost, I've found it awe-inspiring. So to say that the average person in a democracy does not wield power is a complete fallacy. Because for short periods, they may appear powerless, but in the long run, they are all powerful. There's no question on that.
Now, Vikram, if I may, this is a very important point that I'm about to make, taking off from what Pinaki said. Alexander Pope had brilliantly once said, with forms of government, let fools contest. That which is governed best is best. That is the dilemma I was even harping on, saying one man's dictatorship is another man's benevolence. So let's not get carried away by saying that democracy is the only form of government or governance which enshrines equanimity and equality amongst people. We have seen innumerable times that while you are a democracy in form, in substance, you may be a dictatorship. That's my limited point.
Vikram, I'm coming to you. There's another question which has just come, which is for you. It's talking about, is it a perception problem to be jailing an environment activist who simply edited a toolkit? So taking up from what Pinaki said, the rights of an individual, whether it's in India or abroad anyway, it's not only restricted to voting out or voting in a government. It's also the rights that an individual has, and individual rights, civil liberties, and all of the rest of it, freedom of speech, all the things that we keep debating so often. Would you agree, therefore, with Pinaki that the right of the individual or the power of an individual really comes at the elections and is not... No.
That's not what Pinaki said in any case. He only outlined the rights of a voter as being supreme in the context of an individual right within a democratic setup. But having said this, to come back to your question, which is the current one, regarding the jailing and imprisonment of couple of people, a particular case, as you're talking about the environmentalists. The question is today, what is happening? Do you have freedom of speech and expression as absolute, or is it subject to restrictions within the law and within the constitution, as we the people have adopted it? One. Secondly, is the matter under consideration of a competent court, which is still hearing the matter, and the matter is coming up on Tuesday for further consideration? So, I mean, where is the entire discussion going? Simply because action is taken, and simply because it is against an individual doesn't mean that the action is bad. Simply because an individual is suffering doesn't mean that the individual is right. Simply because we are talking about individuals doesn't mean that we don't talk about the larger public perception. We are talking about what? We are talking about the freedom of speech and expression. We are talking about laws of sedition. We are talking about judicial consideration of the matter in hand. With this in hand, you are looking at a larger public management. Individuals in a particular case will be dealt with in accordance with the laws that we have adopted as people. And that's one statement I wanted to come when Suhail was speaking. The idea is today we are constantly talking about A individual or B individual. Of course, it is very relevant. I am not discounting that theory at all. But where is the question of the public good? When we talk about people, that is different from an individual. And when we talk about power managing, we are talking about the larger public good that you're talking about, whether it's the Kim style of public good or another kind of public good where you're talking about services and other facilities being extended in any manner, whether digital economy, whether migrant laborers, anybody. So the question here is we have to look at the larger vision of public good, and we have to allow our systems to hand themselves down in terms of justice, in terms of equity, in terms of magnanimity, in terms of order.
All right. Amish, a bunch of questions are coming in, which I'm going to try and keep up with all of this. I don't think we have that much time. So, A, you know, Jessica is asking, you're a celebrity writer. If you want a table at a restaurant on a busy night and you pull some strings and secure a reservation, would you consider this an abuse of power? But also, a couple of other questions. Prajakta says, do misuse of power or intention to misuse power increase if one is in power for a long time? Also, Mehak is asking, can you say that power attracts the corrupt? So to your point of your power almost being a test, so some of these people seem to be saying that if you're in power for a very long time, it's likely to increase your chances of abusing it. And also, power itself could be attracting the people who are corrupt or more likely to misuse it.
Yeah, no. Sorry, is that for me or Kim?
For you, I mean, for you.
Okay. No, I agree with what Kim said, that there is a thought that it's fair that power tends to attract the corruptible. It is possible, but it does not attract only the corruptible. And the entire point of checks and balances is if you believe your society is not in a state to prevent the corruptible from taking power, then you put in checks and balances. But remember, checks and balances have their own constraints as well. The Roman Republic collapsed because they simply couldn't get anything done, right? I'm a diplomat, so I shouldn't take names, but there are Western countries who are finding it difficult to get things done, right? And we are in a pandemic situation, right? Again, I'm a Democrat. I support democracy, but there are peoples, there are nations where, in fact, they may not think the way I think. They may say that, boss, they want order and food before any of the finer things of life. Who am I to judge them, right? Lastly, in terms of restaurant reservations, I should tell you, regrettably, I'm in London. The lockdown here, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. You're not getting any reservation. The damn restaurants are shut, so.
So much of that. All right, so Pavan Varma, let me throw it to you. I think this question which is being asked by Gaurav almost takes off from what Pinky was saying. She was referring to the common good and, you know, the big issues and what all you have to also look at. What do the panelists have to say about the problem of dirty hands, the necessity of the powerful to have to do morally dubious things for the greater good? Well, for example, I mean, he's using the example of the firebombing of Dresden by the Allies to defeat the Nazis. But the necessity of the powerful to have to do morally dubious thing for the greater good, is that something which you think is a problem? Because potentially, if you have power, you could justify anything by saying this is in the interest of whatever.
No.
I mean, I will say to you that the whole proposition before us is essentially focused on not that the ideal is not good. The ideal is set out to be good. It is the deviation from the idea that power compels you to make. Therefore, we are talking about the inherent tendencies within the orbit of power to corrupt what set out to be ideal. When Pinky was speaking, I was reminded of the old cliche, the way to hell is paved with good intentions. Everybody begins with the assumption that the principles are laid out and we will operate within them. But I think our proposition is really valid, because what happens in the process of the acquisition of power is that you deviate from the ideal and move elsewhere. And every perceptive thinker, Vikram, Amish mentioned Chanakya, the Arthashastra. I think preceding Machiavelli by millennia, Chanakya said, absolute power can happen, and therefore there must be stringent checks on the authority of the king, and lays them down, because his assumption is based on the practical experience of a thinker and insightful observer, that this is what power does to people. That is what we are saying our proposition is based upon. There is no point recounting to us the idealistic principles of democracy, because you see that power corrupts you in spite of them even today in the modern era.
All right. So,
if you read Amartya Sen's superb book called The Idea of Justice, there he talks about two basic concepts. One is niti and nyaya. He says niti doesn't necessarily mean nyaya. So, process doesn't mean fairness. And ultimately, justice is all about fairness. But the second point is very interesting, which Pawan alluded to, which Kim talked about, is how do we interpret the use or abuse of power? And Amartya Sen's point is that when Krishna and Arjun were going to war, did Krishna not know that in the wake of war, there would be death, destruction, widows, there'd be ravaging? And yet he went along, and yet he went on. So I'm not passing any value judgments here. I'm saying sometimes the interpretation of the mechanism of power in itself is flawed to suit our conveniences and our needs. It is our contention, therefore, that it is not that there is no good on this planet. Our feeling is that evil has for long used machinations and used its pernicious influence to emasculate humanity.
All right, I'm going to come to closing comments from everybody right now. Just one last question from Subhash. Pinaki, this is to you. Do you think checks and balances are working in a robust manner as they should in our democracy right now?
You know, there's always an ebb and flow with checks and balances. History has shown, every country has shown, every society has shown that there have never been one gold standard or platinum standard of checks and balances. It will always be, a little bit of a curve going down, a little bit of a curve going up. There is therefore going to be the blips, the occasional blips under this thing. But I believe when the fundamentals are sound and when the people are as vigilant as they are in modern day society, and I just don't mean India, I mean globally. I mean, look at what's happening in America, for instance, with, you know, all the movements that are revolutionary there. So it's not just us in India that we need to sort of be worried about. All over the world, I believe there are checks and balances. Robert Kim talked about Russia. It was inconceivable to have the kind of public agitations and street demonstrations there against President Putin, who's probably the last vestige of absolute power, along with MBS, as Suhail said in Saudi Arabia. These two are the last. But I believe checks and balances, as long as the foundation is solid, there will be individuals who will be manning it for very brief periods who may, give in. But eventually, I think the robust infrastructure and superstructure in place will keep it going. And our constitution is a very, very robust constitution, which I believe in the long run is going to hold us in very good stead.
And Vikram, don't only go by the political interpretation. Corporate world, we have seen in America what the Halliburtons and what the Monsantos did. So it depends on how you define the usage of power and its eventual influence over humanity.
Also, right. Suhail and Pawan have had to really labor today. You have to labor extra hard.
We are against four formidable minds, and there are just two minds battling four formidable minds, which two are lawyers who can switch intellectual variants and opinions so quickly.
Suhail, it is time for closing comments from everybody. And yes, it is that very 2 minutes each with that drum roll, which is going to take place. Any of you want to change sides, even at this stage, please. But otherwise, I'm going to go in the same order that I did. Pawan Narma, your closing comments.
All I think, once again, to reiterate, power in itself is not bad. The interaction of power with the individual, as demonstrated by history, more often than not, leads to corruption. That corruption need not necessarily be financial. It may be deviation from avowed principle in order for the perpetuation of that power. Now, this is what history has taught us. We definitely can pay tribute to democracy. We can say the individual matters. We can look at the institutions and say they are checks and balances. But all of them exist with renewed emphasis only because it does not undermine the essential premise that power in conjunction with individuals more often than not, and enough to prove our support for the motion today, corrupts rather than elevates an individual.
Okay. Last closing comment from you.
Look, Vikram, the debate topic is all power corrupts, right? So the people speaking for it have to show that in every single case, power corrupts. What our side has to do is show exceptions. I think we've shown more than enough exceptions. We can show even the example of Chanakya, who wrote Arthashastra, Chanakya Niti. He himself took power to remove the Nandas and he didn't create any corruption. He didn't create any dynasty but for himself, right? So therefore, that power was used for good. Exception. So therefore, it breaks that point. When you're speaking of a powerful person being ruthless for the greater good, King Suhail Dev. He fought the Turkic invaders, Mahmud Ghazni's army in an extremely ruthless manner, right? What was the impact of the Tata dynasty for himself? He ensured that India wasn't invaded once again for 150 years. Isn't that good? So power was used for good. Power did not corrupt. Exceptions. Therefore, I remain against this motion, and so should the audience actually.
I'm tempted to ask you whether you would be voting differently if instead of the word all, it said most power corrupts, or in a majority of cases power corrupts.
That's quibbling over words.
You didn't define it clearly. There you go.
That's what the topic is. All right.
They're all supportive of our...
All is there.
Yeah, it's okay. Fine. We are getting somewhere. Pinaki, you next.
So I completely agree with my co-panelist, Amish. There is no question that the proposition all power corrupts is a fallacy. Power has been used and history is replete with examples of how power has been used for the larger good of people. And really, you know, the fact is power is at the bedrock of all society in terms of the social structure we are in. We wouldn't be where we are today, Vikram, in the 21st century, in the kind of scientific temper that we have in this world, without power having been exercised diligently and well for the people. And the proposition, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, certainly cannot be the absolute truth, because history, again, is replete with examples of where absolute power has not been used corruptly. It has been, in very few exceptional cases, been used corruptly and then been weeded out immediately. So therefore, our proposition holds clearly.
All right. Kim, you next.
I remain against the proposition. Power per se doesn't necessarily corrupt. I repeat that it attracts the corruptible. It heightens pre-existing ethical tendencies towards corruption. Pinaki quoted Abraham Lincoln. If he allows me, I will repeat what he said. Nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. And so to rebut Suhail as well, I do believe strongly that democracy is the only system where the powerful can be challenged, where there is recourse to justice and right, and where you can therefore curtail the power of those who are abusing it. So let's make sure that good people rise to power and remind them every day of their duty to maintain empathy, ethics, and moral standards, and reinforce the checks and balances that allow good governance and accountability, and make sure that therefore that evil power can continue to be used for good.
Okay, thank you, Anand.
Vikram, I think it's very clearly against the proposition. And I'll go back to even Lord Acton. Lord Acton didn't say power corrupts or all power corrupts. He said power tends to corrupt. That is the best statement that came from him. And then, of course, he goes into absolute corruption and absolute power, leading to corruption otherwise. But that is the best that can go with that proposition. This proposition is wholly incorrect, erroneous, and based on absolutely misfounded notions. Second, the proposition I made earlier. You do need power to control and manage society. We as the people of this world, and coming from ancient times till now, have decided that we need to have a social structure in place where we give power to some people to manage, because every individual cannot be an individual in his own right and go the way he wants. So we go back to Plato, we go back to Socrates, we go back to ideal societies. Somebody has to govern, somebody has to control, somebody has to take a decision. It may be right or wrong, that's another matter. Just last month, on Lord Krishna fighting the battle, and despite that there being damage, in war there is damage. Decisions have to be taken. You do take decisions, and that is the entire basis. So the whole proposition is an absurdity on its own.
So Hale said, last word against the motion, for the motion of the Gavad.
I'm going to say something which you should bear in mind for the rest of your lives. Humanity always uses its interpretive skills to justify abuse or use. And this is serious. What did Brutus say to Mark Antony in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar? He said, it's not that I loved Caesar less, but I loved Rome more. That was a justification for murder. Our contention is that over time, history is replete with examples that yes, there is always need for greater good. As Kim rightly said, as Pinaki said, there are many instances of people actually coming to power and then doing good. But those are the exceptions. So for Amish to say that they will win this debate on the basis of exceptions is like saying that you will win a general election because seven people who you thought were bright voted for you, whereas 7 million voted against you. Number one. Number two.
It's not a general election.
You're a man of intellect and erudition. You know more than anyone else that you can always switch the topic like Pinky Anand tried to do with the deftness and sleight of hand that only lawyers can exhibit by now criticizing the proposition. So she's not willing to argue or debate. She has now debunked the proposition. So if you're debunking the proposition, then you have belief in nothing. This is what our danger is.
The power of the drum finally, so he wins.
But the last power.
Not a general election. Power. This is a JLF debate.
Yeah, fine. But anyway, the power of the drum has won, and the power of the clock has also won right now.
Thank you for listening to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please subscribe or follow to this show wherever you're listening to this.